This is Conor Lennon from UN News. The work of the UN department responsible for peace building is becoming increasingly complex, encompassing problems from cybersecurity to the climate crisis. Rosemary DiCarlo, a veteran diplomat, has been in charge of the Department of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, or DPPA, since 2018. In a wide-ranging interview, Ms. DiCarlo talks to me about the evolving role of the department and her hopes for the future of global security. She started by giving me an overview of the wide range of activities covered by DPPA.
DPPA, the Department of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, has a worldwide mandate. We follow activities, issues in all countries in the world. Our job is to support the Secretary General as he reaches out to try to prevent conflict or resolve a conflict. We have, over the years, played different roles. We certainly do our fair share of policy analysis, but we are extremely active in providing mediation services. And that is bringing people together to the table for dialogue in the event of any disagreements, conflicts that may arise. Our department has a standby team of mediators, of individuals who are very experienced in intercommunal dialogue, in constitution drafting, security sector reform, a whole range of issues that are important and happen to be often at the very base of mounting conflicts.
How important is it for both sides to feel comfortable that they can speak freely and that word won't get out about everything that they're saying, the behind-the-scenes aspect of your work?
Absolutely important. First of all, we're impartial. We approach every situation from a very impartial perspective. Our first priority is to build the trust with our interlocutors, but also to ensure the confidentiality. A lot of what we do is never written about and certainly never disseminated because our goal is the following. We want people to be able to come together and on their own feel as if they have come to an agreement that will be lasting between them.
And given the fact that so much of what you do can't be spoken about publicly, do you ever feel frustrated that the work you do is misrepresented or not understood sufficiently?
I think the frustration is more in that the work is not known. So when often we hear member states or individuals questioning the merits of the United Nations, you know, what does it do? What does it do for people? What are they all doing there? They're sitting in meetings. It's very hard when you realize that you've had people in the field working very hard to bring sparring groups together. But it's not something we're necessarily going to talk about, that we've actually been involved, or even certainly never reveal the contents of what the discussions have been.
That's interesting. So even member states themselves don't quite understand what you do.
I think this is... It's not, I wouldn't say they don't understand what we do, but they are not always aware of the amount of activity that DPPA undertakes in a given year.
Now, you may not be able to answer this question, but I'll try it anyway. Can you give me any examples, recent or not so recent examples, where preventive diplomacy, the work you do, has had a tangible effect?
Well, we've had a number of instances where we have been able in particular to diffuse tensions surrounding elections. A particular leader who, you know, would like to extend his mandate. And we've managed to have discussions and bringing parties together, look at legislation, etc. Or disputed elections, which are extremely difficult to overcome in many different societies. And we've sent usually an experienced diplomat, sometimes a former UN official, sometimes a former high-level official from a member state, to lead discussions on the way forward and to look at whether, for example, the parties can accept the results of an election or in some cases lead to redoing certain aspects of an election.
And you said that your job is to support the Secretary General. Could you explain a bit more detail about how you interact with the Secretary General and how your office works together with his office?
Well, first of all, we're part of the, I am part of the Secretary General's senior management team. We meet frequently as a group, and the Secretary General is very, very concerned that we look at all aspects of a given issue. For example, we, those of us who are dealing with peace and security, have to take and bear in mind the development aspects, the humanitarian aspects of any given situation. So we are frequently meeting as a group on specific issues, but also my office in particular feeds the Secretary General a lot of analysis about what is happening in the world. We are proposing various initiatives and working with him to decide where we can best put our efforts in the world.
Now, he's spoken a lot about mediation since the beginning of his mandate. He set up a high-level advisory board on mediation in 2017. Let's talk a little bit about that. How does that work, and how do you interact with this advisory board?
Okay, we have a wonderful group, 18 individuals on this advisory board, all of them very experienced in diplomacy, in mediation. If we see an issue in Latin America where there are disagreements between the government and the protesters, let's say the government and the opposition, and we might ask one of our members with experience in the region to deploy for a few days, for a few weeks, to help resolve, you know, any disagreements. Sometimes we do this in conjunction with other organizations. We're not the only ones. But certainly we have found that our 18-member board has been extremely helpful to us in actually going into the field on occasion. But they also provide us with guidance and wisdom from their past experiences.
Because many of them are former leaders of their countries.
Former leaders, former foreign ministers, you know, former fairly high-level officials who really have done a great deal in their own careers, who are now helping us to help look at a situation and help mediate a conflict or prevent a conflict from arising.
And would you say they've had a significant impact?
I think they've had a very important impact. One area that we've worked a lot with with the board is on inclusion, in particular inclusion of women and youth in various political processes, peace processes. We have used both the male and female members of the board in this effort.
And can you tell me some more ways in which your office is working to increase the involvement of women and youth?
Well, first of all, we have now asked all of our envoys in the field, our special representatives, to, when they do their periodic reporting to the Secretary General, to the Security Council, to include aspects related to women and youth in all of their analysis. That is one. Second, when we are the ones leading a particular negotiation, a peace process, we are very clear that a certain percentage of the participants have to be women, and they should meaningfully participate, not just be there. I will give you one example, and this is in Syria on the Constitutional Committee that was just launched a few weeks ago. We were very, very worked very hard to ensure that we have 30% female participation in that committee of 150 members.
And the advisory board on mediation itself is split 50-50. Mm-hmm. Now, you've also mentioned that you have other partners, so you interact with academia, civil society, think tanks. How do you bring in those voices into your decision-making process?
Well, we meet frequently, obviously, with think tanks, with experts on given issues. When I travel, and my colleagues when they travel, we meet with civil society in the countries that we visit. It's been extremely useful to get diverse opinions from civil society groups. They can be groups that are dealing with women or refugees or displaced persons or various issues. But it has been extremely helpful, and we make it a practice to be sure to hear their voices when we're in the field.
Now, working with member states is hard enough when you're trying to resolve conflict, but we're seeing a change in the conflict landscape. We've seen it over the last few years, an increasing involvement of non-state actors. What impact has that had on your work?
It has had a significant impact, I think. I mean, first of all, working with a state, with a government, with a certain body of people is defined. Non-state actors can be quite diverse, and one is not sure that one is actually, you know, this, it's not the same as setting up negotiations between two different groups, you know, government, opposition, two different governments, etc. But there, it's not the only thing that's changed, I think, in the landscape. It's not just the increase in non-state actors that have been involved in what we would say could be potentially destabilizing activities. But we see, I mean, climate has had a huge impact on security in certain areas. It's not, we don't know as much about it, but it's a threat multiplier. And we've seen this in Africa, for example, with farmers and herders fighting over land, the displacement of people that then leads to, let's say, intercommunal tensions, in some cases intercommunal violence in certain parts of the world. Innovation, which we are very keen to grasp and reap the benefits of innovation in our work. On the other hand, we know that, for example, new technologies could also be destabilizing and there are risks involved. So there are many areas that we have to take into account now. It is not the traditional state-to-state disagreement or even, you know, ruling party versus opposition party disagreement that we're dealing with.
When you talk about your department having to factor in climate change, which, as you said, is described as a threat multiplier, it sounds like the work you're doing is becoming very complex. And in the current setup that you have, is it still possible to keep a handle on all these different cross-cutting threads, or do you think there needs to be a wider reform?
First of all, the way we do it is by working with other parts of the UN system. I'll give you an example on climate change. We have a mechanism. It's a little cell that exists in our policy division, and it's DPPA, along with the UN Environmental Program and the UN Development Program. And we've been working together now for about a year and a half, looking at the impact of climate change on security and looking at ways, when I say to mitigate this impact, I'm not talking about mitigating the actual changes in climate. I'm talking about dealing with, let's say, the communities that find themselves displaced and making very clear that this can be, in many cases, an early warning to what could be more serious, let's say, violence or conflict.
Let's talk a little bit more about the potential frustrations. I'm sure there are many, the intractability of certain situations, non-state actors or even state actors who are very resistant to your mediation efforts. So what are the biggest frustrations that you face?
I think that one of the big frustrations, that first of all, is being understood, and you mentioned this earlier. Obviously, again, we go in an impartial way. We're not going in with a certain mindset of how something should end. We just want people to come together to be able to decide for themselves how to move forward. And if we can help that through mediation, that's what we do. So it is building that trust and having others understand what we are doing. I think there is a concern on the part of some member states, some individuals, that our actions could be perceived as interference in internal affairs, which is not at all what we are trying to do. First of all, we only go when we're invited. We only go when people seek our help. We offer our help, of course, but we don't force ourselves upon them.
Do you think the role has become more difficult or easier, or is it just simply the fact that you have to be endlessly flexible?
I think the role probably has become somewhat more difficult. First of all, there are you know, many conflicts in the world. The changing nature of conflicts, as we've just talked about, I think makes it more difficult. The fact that we have to become up to speed on so many issues that traditionally weren't really part of what a political department was dealing with, you know, like climate, like innovation, cyber, for example. These are all areas that are new to us over the last few years, where we've got to build up the capacity, the understanding ourselves to be able to take steps to move forward.
And if we look at the global landscape now, the political conflict landscape, what are your biggest fears?
I think for me, the biggest fears are that I would say that there's probably a difference in interpretation of the principles on which this organization was based. That the consensus that seemed to exist earlier doesn't seem to be as solid in any way as it had been in the past. And if you look at how people, different individuals or countries might look at issues of sovereignty, what does that mean? What does sovereignty mean? Use of force, principles basically that are in the charter and that have guided the functioning of the international community over the last 74 years.
And why is that? Is it because we're so far removed from the post-World War II conflict landscape?
I think that just that I don't really know the answer to why it is. I can give some ideas of why I think this might be. I think that there is a sense that what worked for us doesn't work now. There is also perhaps, there was always perhaps a difference of views, but it never was manifested in quite the way it is manifested today. We went from, as the Secretary General talks about, we went from a bipolar to a unipolar to a multipolar world, which is making things quite different and more complicated. On the one hand, many benefits on the other.
Well, we talked about the fears. What about hopes then? What would you hope to achieve by the time you end your mandate?
Well, I would hope to, first of all, leave a department that has all the tools that it needs in order to deal with conflict prevention, conflict resolution. And we have a lot of tools. We need to keep developing them. So that would be, at first, my hope to be able to leave that behind. I think, secondly, to really have a genuine support for the ideas the Secretary General has put forward on prevention. And he talks about conflict prevention, but preventing climate change, preventing a number of things. And we have already the General Assembly that has embraced the concept of sustaining peace. And it's very clear in the resolution the General Assembly adopted in 2016 that sustaining peace means looking at the world through a sort of prevention lens. And I think we have to do that in all of our activities. It is not just what my department does, it's what the rest of the UN does as well.